When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Psychovertical podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. Before we begin this podcast, a little warning. This podcast contains very strong language and ideas that you may find upsetting. The reason I'm putting a warning here is today's episode. Is it an episode? Today's thing is on the subject of resilience. Now, I should have gone away. I should have spent all week sort of working out about resilience and stuff, but I haven't. So I've just got like a jumble of thoughts in my head to do with resilience, because resilience seems to be something, you know, like a lot of people seem to talk about these days. Which maybe that's a sign. Maybe that's more important. Why do people keep talking about it? Maybe that's, we should ask that question. Recently, I don't really watch much television. In fact, I don't think, apart from film four, maybe I kind of avoid watching any kind of television. Someone said recently that the number of people watching like non-fiction TV is massively falling. Like, a lot of people watch, you know, like box sets and things. Like, I've just watched the last episode of The Boys, which is pretty good. But it's a good example of what I'm talking about here, is that everything's got like a message these days. Like, nothing seems to just be fiction, as it's supposed to be. It's always got some kind of a message kind of in there, and even the Boys, you can sort of see it. It's always that anyone to do with the military is always a Nazi right wing person who's trying to take over the world, and anyone who is, you know, it's always all people with money are evil bastards who are trying to exploit, you know, what, you know, all this kind of stuff. So the more you sort of see that kind of thing, the more you sort of switch off. And like non-fiction, the non-fiction world is crazy enough as it is anyway. So but I was watching the television somewhere, and there's one of those programs, those kind of SAS, Are You Tough Enough programs, and it was one of those, what I think it's probably like a syndicated idea, in that everywhere in the country you'll have, like in Ireland here, they had like the Rangers are like a special forces here. Like, in, I think in Ireland's only got like about 5,000 soldiers, and most of them are in like Lebanon or some sort of, you know, somewhere unpleasant place, that acting as peacekeepers. So, but they have this sort of special forces kind of unit called the Rangers, and they had a program here like Rangers, Are You Tough Enough? So it's very you know, maybe I'm sure that anywhere in the world, anyone who's like in the special forces, they always seem to make these programs about them. But the program was, you know, a load of people who were, I guess they were supposed to, either they were like people like Jordan. I don't know how anyway, so you had like kind of like celebrities who were famous for being famous, and then you had some sort of sports people type people, and you know, footballers and that kind of stuff, and they were just kind of put through the paces by these, you know, SAS kind of special forces kind of people. Like those kind of programs, I hate to say it. The only special forces person I don't really mind is probably Bear Grylls, because he wasn't in the special forces really, but yes, he was. I did actually get a message from Bear Grylls recently. If you are listening, Bear, thank you for the message, telling me that my podcast about Bear Grylls was very funny or something, but that the SAS story wasn't true. Although I do know someone who told me, someone who was in the SAS, who said it was true. So we shall see about that anyway. So anyway, this, but I always find these programs with these SAS people kind of a little bit, they kind of give me the creeps a little bit, because I always think that they're always like, they're always kind of sort of very damaged people. Like, I know probably Aunt Middleton's going to come and want to murder me or something, but I think a lot of those people, like the people you would employ in that kind of job of basically sort of someone who can like laying a bush, you know, or like a, you know, a void in a roof or something for like a couple of weeks, crapping in plastic bags and then looking at people, and then sort of get together and go and kill that person. It's a very unique set of skills, I think those people are, it's like if you had a program called Can You Work in an Abattoir, and they had a load of like people who worked in abattoirs, and people would be like, oh my god, these people who work in abattoirs, they're a bit weird, aren't they? They're not kind of normal. And you see the kind of environment of working in abattoir, like if you ever seen like meat being rendered or all that kind of stuff, it really is at the coal face of some serious dark shit, really. And I think the SAS thing is the same, really. No offense to anybody in the SAS. I have met quite a lot of people. I've done some like work for the army, not assassinations and things, but so I've actually met quite a lot of these people, and you know, a lot of them are kind of not like normal people, but some of them aren't. And like, I think Aunt Middleton always kind of scares me, and they always have these photographs. They always have, there's some kind of chic, like killer chic, which I find is a little bit upsetting. You can, like, a lot of the people who like Aunt Middleton and these people, like killers basically, are people who are like pacifists, and they don't eat red meat, and they, you know, they're kind of the, you know, in the Hunger Games, they're the kind of people living the capital. And Aunt Middleton or these kind of SAS people are basically, you know, Jocko Willink, these people, like they're like the people who were like the gladiators, you know, they're the ones who always win the competition because they're cold-blooded killers, really. So although it was quite cool, I quite enjoyed seeing Aunt Middleton sort of begging for forgiveness for saying that the COVID wasn't that bad or something, and he did the classic hands clasped together, please forgive me kind of thing. So it shows you that probably, you know, it's not all real, really. So on this program, they had all these people, you know, jumping into the cold water and having to carry like a Klepper kayak and things. And what is interesting, the people who look the least resilient are often the ones who are the most resilient. Like, they have nothing. I don't know why that is, but you know, the big roughy tufty guy who's like the fighter or the rugby player, like often they'll be like totally pathetic, and the, you know, the tiny little woman who's from, you know, from show jumping or something, like they're like totally hardcore. But at the end of this program, you know, you watch this program and they're all shouting at them and, you know, pulling themselves apart. And at the end of the program, there was this like a warning, and not a warning, but like, if you found anything in this program upsetting, then, you know, please ring this number for our helpline. And And I was like, really? I was really shocked. Like, I don't watch much British TV, so maybe that's the end of every program these days. But the idea that you could voluntarily go and watch a program about celebrities being, you know, basically beasted by some ex-soldiers, that would like traumatize you to the point where you'd have to ring someone up and speak to a counselor. It was like, fucking hell, like, what's the world coming to? And I think I sort of like tweeted something like, have we got is it that we don't have a mental health problem, we have like a mental sort of weakness problem? And of course, whenever you say a thing like this, like at the moment we have all these religions, like new religions, so we have sort of race religions, and we have like environmental religions, and it's kind of a mental health religion. Like if you add the word mental health to things, it's like a little holy kind of thing, you know. So sometimes these can all kind of intermingle each other, but often a sign of a religion is something where you can't question it. You can't question someone else's belief. You know, so if I make a joke about eating meat or something, you know, or like only the bourgeoisie, only the middle class can afford an electric car. Most people, you know, a lot of people don't have a car. You know, people will like completely attack you, like, do you not believe in global warming, and you know, and all these kind of things. So the mental health one is a little bit like that. Like anyway, it's kind of weaponized. You'll always hear like politicians and grifters and all these kind of people will always be throwing in the word mental health as ammunition to prove how important it is what they're saying, you know. Like personally, I find masturbation is very, you know, very important in my mental health. So anyone who wants to try and stop me doing it on the bus, you know, like they're, you know, enough said. So I don't actually go on the bus very often. That's really why I'm banned. So of course, like, because I said, like, have we got like a mental, a weakness kind of thing? People, you know, you just got all these people like saying, how dare you say that? And I've got this, and, you know, I've been diagnosed with whatever, you know, and it's just the same old thing. Like even the word weakness is something that's like, it's like triggers people, because it's like saying, just because I'm weak doesn't mean that, you know, that you can call me weak, or just, it's not weakness, it's like a lack of strength. And I'm like, what, like a weak person? And some people like listening to this now will be thinking the same thing, like, oh my god, like I have problems with anxiety, or I have all these things, and I'm not weak. And but you are, really, you know, that's the thing. So this is not for you, really, this podcast, because I think basically, if you are like, I will totally admit it, I am like totally weak. Like the other day, Vanessa bought a packet of Special K, but some sort of Happy Shopper version of Special K, or Lidl Special K. And I was like, why have you bought them? I'm going to eat them all. And she's like, no, you won't. You'll control yourself. Anyway, so within like 24 hours, I'd eaten all of them, which is actually quite good. I would have eaten all of them in an hour, but I had one bowl, and I had another one bowl the next day. So, but I proved my point, you know, like I will eat them all. So I'm a very, when it comes to cereal, I am like incredibly weak. Like I might be able to go and, you know, solo a big wall, or head off into the mountains and whatever, or stand in front of like thousands of people, tell my stories. But when it comes to cereal, I am seriously weak. So I'm not talking about this from a position of like, oh, look at me, how good I am at not eating cereal. There was a thing. It was again back to the SAS thing. So if anybody here is into the SAS, this is good for you. Got lots of like SAS kind of chat, really. So there was someone told me a story, and he was somewhere with a load of like American soldiers, and they were like in the SAS, and they were talking about the problem. They were like, you know, this thing, like the pro, you know, how do the British Army deal with this problem of finding people to go into a room, you know, go into the, run towards the, you know, the firefight or whatever, go into this room and kill people. And the guy was like, we didn't know it was a problem. So, and I think maybe this is probably true of this kind of mental strength and resilience. It was never really a problem before. You know, so the fact it's a problem could potentially be like a side effect of a positive thing. So like in almost everything, like positives can lead to negatives and vice versa. Now it's a very good way of seeing the world. You know, so I would say, you know, like it's a, so you know, often things can seem like, oh, this is a fantastic outcome, but the long term results of it can be like really, really, really bad, you know. So Barack Obama winning, you know, becoming a president is really, really good, unless you're like Libyan or Syrian, then that's really, really not very good for you. So the reverse is true. So, you know, you create the internet and you have all these amazing ways of people to finally communicate with each other. Like everyone's like a pen pal, but you realize that everyone just like hates each other. So you have these, you know, so there's a good way of thinking about things, like this positive thing in my life, you know, could be very negative in the long run, and vice versa. The vice versa is probably more important because there's probably more bad stuff that happens to you in your life than good stuff, which is probably better. Probably you don't want to have too much good stuff because you just get used to it. So in the past, I think the idea of like, you know, like if you were in the Somme, so, you know, you're in your trench and there's rats running everywhere and there's bits of human body hanging off the barbed wire, you know, and someone said to you, "Oh, Mick, you're so resilient," you know, and he'd be like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" I think so. In the past, I think the reason people were much more resilient, and the reason why, like, if you ever, like, all these kind of books about SAS people, that kind of stuff, like, but basically all of them like were in a borstal or something, or they were like in prison. They all have exactly, any book about like any soldier always begins with like, I was in borstal or whatever. I was like beaten up as a child by my parents or something. They always begin in this thing. So they're like negative, their negative early life ends up making them like really good at killing people. So, but there was a really good example of this was, I saw this interview recently with, what's his name? Martin, is it Martin McGuinness? No, that's the Irish, thingy McGuinness. Anyway, the guy who started the Proud Boys, which is the only neo-Nazi white supremacy movement headed by a black sort of Mexican guy. But it was an interview with him, Gavin McGuinness, and this guy, Christian O'Brien, who's got a website. He's got a YouTube channel, like 1791, which is, I find it a very good channel. And he was talking, like, I don't think Gavin McGuinness is a Nazi or a racist or whatever. I actually find it very, very funny. And the fact that you might think is a Nazi or a racist, or the Proud Boys are like neo-Nazis, probably means you're also, that's also maybe a sign of weakness, maybe, because maybe there's also an aspect of culture at the moment where people aren't kind of willing to go to source material and consult it because they find it like too upsetting to, you know, they physically feel the pain. So this idea of like safe spaces and trigger warnings and all this, it's because people like I feel like actual pain. So for me, even saying Gavin McGuinness or Proud Boys, you know, straight away your reaction is like, oh, Andy must be a member of the Proud Boys, or he's a neo-Nazi. And even if I'm saying, well, in my view, I don't think they're neo-Nazis. I think they're just like the same as like when I lived in London, you know, you had like Nazis and you had anti-Nazis. And basically they were both the same. They're just like having a massive fight with each other. There's no difference from from football hooligans. They're all exactly the same. They don't really like the. I don't know if you know this, but the reason like why football hooliganism ended was ecstasy. Like all these people who are trying to kill each other and stabbing each other with razors. I don't think they tried to kill each other, but they were like, you know, but a bit, they were a bit stabby and stuff. You know, like in the '80s, they all started taking ecstasy and they all got over it. So I reckon that's what we need. We need like the extreme, like all the Antifa and all the Proud Boys. We need to get them on ecstasy, and the world will be a much happier place. So, but in this interview with Gavin McGuinness, he's telling this story about being on some program, and there was this kind of, you know, like right wing woman or something. Now, right wing doesn't mean Nazi. Just point that out. There's to have a left wing, you have to have a right wing, and you have to have the extreme middle. Anyway, so he said to this woman, like, "Oh, wow, you're really, really beautiful. Like, how come you're right wing? You must have a father who like was, you know, was incredibly badly burned or something." And I think that was maybe that was true. But this idea that people who are kind of tough mentally, like that mental kind of toughness or that resilience, is always going to stem. I would say, like, you're not going to get resilience from listening to this podcast. Like, you either, unless you're really, really young, unless you're like six, then you're fucked. If you're 36, you're fucked. If you don't think you're resilient, then, you know, you've had it anyway. It doesn't matter about it. So but all the shit things in your life that happen to you, you know, they're all just kind of building up this what would you call it? It's kind of money in the bank, basically, for later on. I guess it's the same with you know, when you get punched in the face the first time, you know, it's like really not very nice. But when you punch in the face like the thousandth time, you know, you don't even feel it. You know, it's not that bad. So the hard kind of hard times you have in your life, like, you know, having your heart broken or getting divorced or, you know, people, you know, like dying and, you know, all this, you know, seeing people, you know, with like, you know, grandparents with dementia and all these kind of things, like they're kind of what life is all about in a way. Like all the nice stuff. Maybe this is like I'm not a Catholic, but maybe it's like a Catholic kind of thing. But, you know, but I always say that, like, one thing that sets apart someone who is working class and someone who is kind of middle class is that working class people are always on the edge. They always feel like they're on the edge of something bad happening, whether it's they're going to lose a job or just you know, they haven't got any, they've got no real cushioning. You know, like your washing machine stops working, you know, you're fucked or whatever. You know, there's always something bad is about to happen. And I guess in the past that's kind of been borne out because, you know, like if you're middle class, you have some money in the bank and you're not thinking. Like, that's often my argument about the global warming environmental stuff, is that people who often talk about it the most are talking about 50, 100 years into the future. You know, where most people are only thinking about, you know, next week, or some people are only thinking about tomorrow, whatever. So those people who are only thinking about tomorrow, they have this like, they're always on edge the whole time. And yet, I don't think those people are actually suffering from anxiety the same as the people who basically have nothing to worry about. They're living in a house, they might have a biggish mortgage, but they have like they have some kind of asset, even if it's just that they're, you know, they're well educated, they could just get they have a degree, you could go and live in Canada or Australia or whatever. So where most people, you know, if you're living in Hull or Doncaster or whatever, you're basically fucked, basically. You're never gonna move anywhere else. That's where that's it. So but because those people are never really thinking too far ahead, I think they don't seem to you know, if you look at sort of working class kids and sort of middle class kids, the middle class kids always seem to be more, have more problems, like panic attacks and, you know, stress and self-harming. And maybe that's not true, but it seems to me that the more you have something to actually worry about, the less you worry about it, in a way. You know, this is the really terrible thing about working class people is they just spend all their money immediately. Like, you know, when you meet people who are really, really wealthy, they never spend any money at all. They just put it all in the bank. They're very frugal. You know, they don't make these stupid purchases. Where I just know from my own family, as soon as anyone gets any money, they just spend it on, like, they'll buy a blow up swimming pool or something. It's like, it's a weird thing. So, but maybe that's another thing, is that that people don't hold on to what they get because they know they know it might get taken away, you know, if that makes any sense. Rather, it's better to have, like, a big blast of a firework than some kind of, some very long, like a long fart that goes on for like a few weeks till all the money's gone. This is the worst talk about resilience ever. If I wanted to think of some like concrete things about resilience, I would probably say that you need some kind of physical resilience to begin with. That's like you found it. That's like your foundation. And I think because a feeling of weakness, because that's what we're kind of talking about, you're susceptible to anxiety or stress or feelings of suicidal feelings or just general depression. It's a little bit like you are allowing yourself to be more easily affected by things which will like trigger those emotions inside you. And so those are kind of maybe secondary things, but mainly like, so the anxiety and everything else, and the resilience is something which maybe allows you, it's like having some kind of inbuilt resistance to those feelings. And I think often it's to do with feelings of being weak, of feeling weak, not necessarily being weak, but feeling weak and vulnerable, or feeling out of control. Like anger, one reason why you see a lot of anger on social media is not that people are angry, it's that they feel out of control, and they feel they need to have this. Like, that's why religion is very effective, because it gives people a system where, you know, like God or whoever is not gonna let you down. You know, he might punish you or do some shit, you know, like a tsunami might wipe out your whole country, but, you know, that was just God being God. But he's never gonna let you down like politicians do, or, you know, someone you like on television suddenly starts voting for someone you don't like, or, you know, whatever. So feelings of not being in control. So, like, for in the UK, it would be like a good example is someone who is against Brexit. Like, I would say the Brexit thing is like 50-50 on both sides. Like, both sides are right, and however, you know, whichever way it went, it could have equally bad outcomes. To be in the EU, you know, the EU could completely collapse, and it could, you know, probably will do anyway. It'd be really terrible. To be out of the EU, you know, your whole trade thing could fall apart, and you just end up being like a basket case of Europe. All that, you know, so both sides are kind of right at the same time. But ultimately, one side maybe mistakenly feels like they're gaining control. So if you're a Brexiteer, you feel you're gaining control of your country. Where the other side, the what they call them, the the Remainers, like they feel like they're losing control. So if that makes any sense. So this is not an argument on either side, but this is a feeling of how people feel. And the same way, like if you support Trump, you know, you feel he's like taking, you know, he's like draining the swamp or whatever, where so you know, anything that's crazy he's doing, it's like yeah, whatever, you know, in the long run this is going to be good. Where if you hate Trump, you're like, you know, this guy has no control over anything. And but like ultimately the control, I would say, is an illusion. It's basically something people sell, you know. That's why religion is very effective, because it gives this illusion of control but without having to do anything. So, you know, like, so no matter what shit happens, it's just God's will. It's no one's fault, but he don't, you know, believe he is totally in control. But when politicians and everybody else sort of take over that role, like forget God, you know, I'm just as good. In fact, I'm better. You know, humans are just, you know, they're just crap. They're just not very good at a lot of this stuff. It's too complex and there's too many variables, and it's always about reacting badly. And then 90% of it is just pretending and covering up, you know, like all conspiracies, everything. It's all about covering up your fuck ups, basically. So we're increasingly able to see how incompetent people we were always thought were competent, at least semi-competent, are now like totally incompetent. And so this is also probably leading into feelings of a lack of certainty, a lack of control, and leading to anxiety and everything else. Unless you're working class, then you probably don't care. So if you have some kind of physical resilience, now I'm talking about this from the perspective of being like a man. Maybe women want something different, but like ultimately, if you like strip it all back down, if you feel like you could, you know, if you feel like if someone came into your house or like attacked you in the street, and you can like leather them and beat them up or whatever, or you know they're not going to kill you or whatever, you could run away really, really well. I reckon that, you know, that if you go right back down to that kind of being in on the savannah and a lion chasing you and your mate, you know, there are some sort of core things. And I think physicality, like feeling strong, feeling fit, feeling healthy, is probably one of the most effective ways of trying to regain some sort of resilience and sort of control of your life. Like even if, you know, there's a classic thing is that you should always, I think it was what's that guy, Jordan Peterson or somebody, or some US Navy SEAL was saying about making your bed. You know, you should always make your bed at the beginning of the day, because no matter how shit the day is, you've always got a bed that's made at the end of it. But the same thing with trying to have some control over your physical world. You know, if things are shit in your life, then going for a run or, you know, going for like a massive walk or going climbing or whatever, they're great, because you will always feel better when you're never going to feel worse when you come back. Like even if you feel fucked, you'll feel great. Feel fucked in a great way. So doing some trying to build that into your life. Like I know loads of people, like the classic thing, like in the past I've written quite a lot about depression and all that kind of rubbish. So, you know, the classic thing I once said to somebody, they were like, what do you do if you've got the black dog, which is, black dog means like depression. And I said, like, get yourself a dog. And they did. And it kind of really helped them, because they had a dog they had to take walking every day, like, you know, twice a day I took this dog for a walk. And they were focusing more on the dog, you know, than just on themselves. But so the act of walking was very good. I think like Will Gadd has this thing about moving, like just keep moving. It's the same, like recently we had someone come here who had like a little, like a 2-year-old who was like, you know, a little bit of a, you know, the type of child who like headbutts you in the face and stuff. Like, so, you know, they were like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And I was like, look, I've had two kids. I'm not interested in fanning on with somebody else's kids. But you could see that they were like struggling with this child. So I just like picked the child up, stuck him on my shoulders, and just like walked out down the street, walked down to the sea or whatever. And like once you're moving, you know, I don't know. So there's something about moving. Like moving is just, it's just good for you. So, like if your wife has left you and you feel like suicidal, and you go for a run, and you come back and you still feel exactly the same, which you probably will do, then, you know, just hang on till your next run. Just keep doing that, and eventually, you know, you'll have such bad like tendonitis or some kind of horrible, you know, running disease, you won't think about it anymore. So yeah, so the physical side, like I keep trying to buy some weights, some belts, some plates for like doing like, you know, weightlifting and stuff, because I've got some kettlebells here, but I haven't got anything else. But you just can't buy them, like months and months and months in, like they're always out of stock everywhere you look. So I think that's a good sign, maybe. Like a lot of people seem to have been switching on to this like physical side, and often in times of like pretty shitty sort of stuff that's going on, you know, people often come out of it more resilient because they've had to deal with mentally come up with a way of dealing with the shit that's going on in their life and around them and the coping strategy. And also they tend to migrate towards this kind of physical kind of side. And like I do know people who have gone from, you know, very kind of angry, bitter, you know, like life is basically over, you know, like I'm so shit, you know, blah blah blah, to slowly getting into sort of training, and it's built like a really solid amount of sort of self-confidence in them, and it's kind of this kind of physical, they know, like if you can go from, you know, if you can start doing deadlifting or whatever, and you're, you know, you go from being this complete loser who can hardly lift the bar off the ground to being someone who can, you know, lift a really impressive amount of weight, like it does make a real difference to the way you hold yourself, the way you think about yourself. You know, and it's really simple stuff, but maybe that is why it's so good. Another thing to think about is avoiding, you know, look into like the idea of like stoicism, like the philosophy of stoicism, like that kind of philosophy, you know, stretched over like thousands of years, probably, you know, it was like hundreds of years. So it began in Greece and it was in the, you know, to Rome, and it's kind of integrated itself into lots of time, but kind of thinking, but there's this thing about, you're in control of how you feel. That's very important. And for all those people who got into weightlifting during hard times, then there was all the other people who didn't, and they just ended up having miserable, depressing lives, just taking loads of drugs or alcohol or, you know, whatever, you know, depression medication or whatever. You know, and that's fine for them, but it's not a good outcome. So there's the flip side. But the one thing you have to realize is that some people kind of like it on a subconscious level. You know, some, I don't know if it's like, if we apply the 80-20 rule, I would probably say that only 20% of people are going to get out of that spiral, and I think the other 80% are just like the living dead. And it's really horrible to say it like that, but that is kind of how it is. So you basically, you have to kind of avoid, you have to, I sound like Tom Cruise in like Steel Magnolia, for it is, but you like those people are, they just don't want to get out of it, really. You know, like you can offer people like these things, you could do these, you could really, you know, like just stop eating shit food, you know, is another good one. You know, like if you eat shit food, you'll just feel shit, and you know, but people don't want to, and they'll make all the excuses. But you just can't help people. You really have to really focus on you. It's a bit like being a first responder in a way. You have to look after yourself to begin with. Otherwise, you know, if you're not there, you're not going to help anybody. So it's been very choosy on who you try and help and who you try and hang out with. Like the classic thing is avoid drains, you know, and hang around radiators. And it's kind of tough. If you do, I find like positive people tend to, you know, I don't really hang out with either positive people or negative people. I don't really hang out with any people. So I hang out with my wife, and she's very positive. So I'm not someone who needs a lot of people to feel positive or negative. But some people do. So, you know, and if you are exposed to negative stuff, so the classic thing would be, you know, comment sections on social media, you know, like just try and cut it out, because it's not going to do you any good. Like it's no good wasting your life energy on a conversation that is meaningless and no one is going to read it apart from you. And, you know, you'll probably regret it. Like in a year's time, you'll go back and look at all the things you said a year before. They're probably all shit. You know, it's just embarrassing basically. So trying to cut all those things out of your life. Like I know I keep saying it, but I try as best as I can to stay away from the social media, but unfortunately it's my job, so I have to kind of engage with it. But I use this thing, is it attention span? No, it's self-control, it's called, on a Mac. I'm sure there must be one for PCs, where I just set it for 24 hours, and once I click it, I can't use Twitter, Instagram, you know, all these kind of things. And I find that very good, because then I don't have to think about it. I don't have to like engage. Like if I'm controversial, if I say something that's going to piss people off on Twitter, by the time I get back onto it, like it's not even worth replying, because it's, you know, the time has passed. And avoid things like, again, I'd avoid, like, you know, like on Vanessa's phone, I like looked on BBC website on Vanessa's phone, and it's about there's some story about a Nigerian serial killer who's being like executed or whatever. But do I need to know that? I don't think I do really. So, you know, if there's like a serial killer, like, you know, in Galway, then I'd probably be interested in that. But anywhere else, I don't really care really. So don't try and fill your life. Like the BBC is the worst for it. Just don't. Yeah, you are going to be an ignoramus, but you know, I was once in Australia. Like my wife is like my, you know, she's my model of being ignorant in a positive way, very progressive, ignorant way. Like we're in Australia, and it was the Queen's birthday in Australia, and Vanessa was like, "Oh my God! Like Australia's got a queen as well." Anyway, she's always often coming up with these really interesting things like that. So I always tell the story how she didn't know that the Twin Towers fell down in September the 11th, because she was out playing football or something. So, but that's a good thing. That's not like a negative thing. So try and like monitor what's going in. Hopefully some of this is to do with climbing. This is supposed to be a climbing podcast. So if I wanted to flip it into a climbing thing, is try and think about you. You know, if you always think about falling off, and if you always think about having a bad accident, like those things are good things to have in the background, really. But like, keep them low down. But you know, try and have like positive thoughts about about the climbing you're doing. Now, I remember Tim Emmett. Now, Tim Emmett is like phenomenal climber, and he's been like a phenomenal climber. Like I first met him when he was like 19, and he's still like climbing like really, really hard in his like 40s. And I remember like Tim, like I was always when I was climbing, like I'm a shit climber, but I'd always be really, really too focused on putting the gear in. I'd always be looking at where the gear was, where Tim would just be looking at where he could have a rest. So he knew if, you know, if you get to this point, you can have a rest, get some gear in, then you can move to the next point, have a rest, get some gear in. Where if you're just thinking about the gear, there's like so much gear on a lot of routes. If you're doing like easier routes, you'll just waste all your energy just hanging around trying to put gear in. So I always thought that was a very positive thing. And he was, and he never seemed to be, he didn't really care about falling off, you know, because he probably, because he was crazy. But, you know, so I guess like turning, a classic one is turning the negative of falling into a positive, as in I enjoy falling off, like bungee jumping. So that's a good, you know, that's a good, you know, trying to flip the script, basically. Well, so I've written like a few things here, was it? So taking control of your thoughts, basically, is like I think, like, I don't know if because I do quite a lot of writing, I think I often listen to how people speak and how they talk about themselves a lot. And people often are very disparaging about themselves, or very disparaging about others, or other ideas or whatever. We're not, often not very consistent in our moral kind of positions, that we allow others to get away with stuff that we don't allow other people to, you know, and the same with ourselves, really. So having some sort of, you know, listening to how you think about yourself and how you speak about yourself is like really, really important. And you can, you know, we're very easy to program human beings. You know, you can just watch, if you know, Netflix for a while, and you'll be thinking different things than what you did to begin with. So, you know, you can attempt to try and program yourself in sort of in positive ways in how you deal with stuff. Like a friend of mine, his son was just dropped out of going into the Air Force because he was struggling with anxiety, and I recommended that he read David Goggins' book. Is it called Can't Kill Me or Can't Hurt Me or something? Now, if you've read this book or listened to this book, I'm sure you'll agree it's like an amazing book about resilience and sort of inner strength and stuff. But if you haven't, then sorry, I've got a drink of tea. Hold on. If you haven't, then sound like all emotional. If you haven't, then get the audio version on Audible, because the audio version has David Goggins is like speaking in between. Now, when David Goggins starts speaking, you'd be like, "Oh my god, who's this retard?" Like, he's just like, "Hi, my name's David Goggins," and you're like, "Oh my god, like this is going to be terrible." So, but stick with it. So David Goggins, for those who don't know, he was a he was basically like kind of abused by his father, and he's kind of black, so he had this like sort of shitty kind of upbringing. He wasn't poor, but he was like, his dad was like a businessman, and he was basically in like an abusive relationship with his father. And then he was someone like most, like everyone, he had like a lot of potential, but he had a lot of log jams in his life and a lot of stuff. He was like self-destructive and self-sabotaging and everything else. And he basically had this weird thing where some people, they feel like they're absolutely shit, but at the same time, they have these incredibly ambitious at the same time. So he tried to be like a pararescue guy who's, you know, like an elite kind of soldier who like parachutes out of planes and rescues people, and he kind of struggled with the swimming. Now, black, like, whether this is true or not, but it seems to be true from when I talk to people, is like, if you're some black people are very dense, physically dense, so they have like a lower buoyancy, so he really struggled with his buoyancy. So we had to go through like the swimming phase of being a pararescue man. He just found it like terrifying. So he didn't manage to be a pararescue man, and he sort of dropped out, and then he went to the Air Force, and then he left. And then he ended up just having a crap job, sort of as a pest control, and he got really, really fat, like 300 pounds or whatever. I don't know, is that fat? I don't know. And then he decided he wanted to be a Navy SEAL, and so he tried like three times. Like, so if you're black, like I think very few black people have ever become Navy SEALs because of probably to do with sort of density. That's why like a lot, like if you're if you're black, you have a much higher chance of drowning. If you look at the statistics, it's not. It's anyway. So so there was a so yeah. So anyway, she tried and tried and tried and tried, and he had shin splints and everything else, and he basically did like Hell Week like three times. But eventually, he becomes a Navy SEAL, and that's just kind of the beginning of the book. You know, the book then goes on to doing ultra running and endurance and all this kind of stuff. So absolutely amazing book, really good. Like, listen to it when we were in like Saudi Arabia, and like whatever we did, we're always like channeling the inner Goggins, like, oh, I can't be asked doing this, but what would Goggins do? And we'd always like think like that. So but what's interesting about the book is like Goggins is still a complete fuck up, basically. You know, he doesn't talk about it, but he's obviously, in a way, he's like turned into his father. Like, he's incredibly driven. You know, he's probably very selfish and self-centered. Like, I think he has like three wives in the book, and there's like children and all sorts of stuff. But he kind of just goes over all that. But he's kind of making the most. He's made the most of what he has, in a way. But it doesn't make, like, I think, you know, to be a very resilient person, like, if I was a resilient person, then calling other people weak wouldn't really upset me, if you know what I mean, because you just have to be maybe a bit less sensitive about what other people think about you, and maybe a little bit less sensitive about you think about yourself. So don't try and overthink things. Like, Goggins is one of these people where he's obviously self-medicating through exercise to deal with a lot of shit, and you know, from those negatives, very dark sort of negatives in his life, you know, he's got some positives, you know, basically killing people in Iraq or whatever. So, but, you know, but it's, you got to make the most of what you've got. And that's what because you are like the manifestation of all the shit in your life. You're not the manifestation of all the nice things. And if you only ever had nice things, and like parents who were well balanced and looked after you, and you know, told you don't have to worry about anything, you'd always be okay, and you'll inherit this house, and we'll get you a job with a friend, and blah blah blah, and we'll take you to university. If you don't like it, we'll pick you up and bring you home, and all these kind of things. And those people are fucked, basically, because they haven't really, they've not had these abusive parents, and you know, neglect, and all those kind of things. But you do. Luckily, life will always, you know, life will sort you out. It'll always, you know, what do you call, like, a, you know, conservative, someone with a conservative, like, mindset is like someone who's been mugged by reality, they often say. So I think life is like that. You might, you know, at 20, you might have this, you might have no real, you know, you might have no real resistance to what's going to happen, you know, in the rest of your life. But by 30, you'll probably have had like some failed relationships. You'll have been made redundant. Maybe you'll have had like some health scares or whatever. So slowly you'll be knocked into shape. But the sooner you can do that, the better. So, but that's down to your parents to be horrible and abusive and stuff. So I guess another thing is kind of spiritual strength. Now, I was thinking about this today, like spiritual strength. As soon as you say the word spiritual, people think you're being religious or whatever. Like, I'm not religious at all, but I am very interested in religion, but without being religious. And I think trying to understand where people are coming from, because I think that part of us, the madness, the mad part of us, which manifests itself in like organized religion, is something that you neglect at your peril, really, because it's a space inside you that will always be filled with something. Like, it could be Subutio or, you know, a model railway building, but it will get filled with something. Now, what fills that is actually very, you know, very important. For a lot of people, it'd be like climbing. It'd be something that's I don't think I even need to go and look at the dictionary definition of spiritual, because I think when you are in touch with that spiritual thing or your spirit, I think we all know what it feels like, don't we? So, and so yeah, I think it's getting older in life, but you know, maybe trying to instead of being like so resistant to other people's religion and just think they're all stupid and retarded and backward, you know, like whether it's Judaism or, you know, Islam or whatever, all the other ones. Like Buddhism seems to be incredibly popular, but I think it's worth like trying to understand the human aspect of it, because I think you're a better for it in a way. I think instead of being so cynical, you know, like you can be. I think getting maybe cynicism is actually a bit of is being resistant to things is actually maybe a negative, like trying to be less cynical about everything and trying to be more interested in things, especially things you're not supposed to be interested in. That's that's kind of good. So I've got my book here, this book I wrote, Me, Myself and I, or Me, Myself and I. Like the first time I published it, someone was supposed to have edited it, so there was no spelling mistakes in it, but actually it's like full of spelling mistakes. But the only thing I had to do that wasn't proofread was the front cover, and just on the back it just says Me, Myself and I, but on the first lot I misspelled myself, so it was like Me, Myself and I. So we was in the house, so it's called it Me, Myself and I. So this was a book I did. It's just about a book about how to solo big walls and stuff. And I just thought I'd read a little tiny bit on it. Might be appropriate. So I think soloing, like if I have any qualifications for talking about resilience, it probably would come from soloing big walls and things. Because when you're on a big wall, you're all by yourself, obviously, and you've got no one there to look at, to support you or to lift, you know, help you lift the load or whatever. You're all by yourself, so you have to come up with ways of not like folding and not being weak, basically, of finding some sort of strength. And I think you can actually find incredible strength even in the middle of like a massive amount of weakness, if you know what I mean. Like, have no doubt about it, if when you're on a big wall and it's like day 10 or whatever and you're absolutely wasted, there is no way that in that moment you are this like incredibly strong heroic human being. You are totally pathetic and weak and whatever. But what you tend to do is, you know, you have this little tiny, you have this like this little flame of strength inside you, which, you know, when you first started it was like a roaring, you know, log fire of strength, but by then it's kind of quite small. It can never go out, really. It's always there somewhere. There's always a little spark of it somewhere. Sometimes you just if that's giving off some kind of power, this little flame of inner strength, then you just have to just go at that, at the speed of that strength, if you know what I mean. Like if you're, you know, like I hate when people say like I've struggled with, or I'm a survivor of this, but like I've had times in my life where I literally could not move off the settee, you know, like I've just not mentally just being like not wanting to do anything whatsoever. And you know, like, so like often that flame is in there, that flame of resilience is saying to you, you may feel like this right now, but you know, this negative will flip into a positive, and you'll look back at this as a positive in your life of, you know, the as dark as things feel, one day this will be a positive. Like, luckily you don't feel like that about negatives. Positives, when it's a positive, you're like, oh, this is cool, but it's not really that. It's, you know, it's fleeting. Like the positives are fleeting, but the negatives like have like real kind of sustain. Like, you want them to end, but you carry them with you, if you know what I mean. Where the positives, like, you know, how many kisses do you have in your life? How many of those do you remember? Like, you know, a few, but not all of them. So how many really shitty things have you done in your life? You know, quite a few, and you remember all of them. So, so I don't want to sound like someone who's saying to be resilient, you have to be this superhuman kind of person. You can actually be, you know, incredibly weak and beaten up and vulnerable. But there was always that strength, because there has to be, isn't there? Really, you know, what's the alternative, really? So, so this is like a little bit in this book. I need to rewrite this book because it's quite old now. But it was all about soloing, and it had, you know, like, one bit was about the mind, which is probably the most important bit. Where is it? So it's got all stuff about failure. Self-empathy. What's that? Self-empathy. In order to survive and thrive on a wall, you must develop self-empathy, or the ability to love yourself. Yes, that's quite it. But don't love yourself too much. That's what I say. get yourself a room. Or keeping on going. This is a little tiny bit. There will be many crises around a climb, doubts about your plans and dreams, and deep feelings of fear and trepidation. In these moments, you will need some way of pressing on. One method is to have a mantra that you use in order to ignore the negative, such as, I will keep climbing, I will get to the top. Or a little story, such as when Royal Robbins made the first solo scent of El Cap. He almost bailed, but decided to place one more pittern. And you recall that basically Royal Robbins, he wanted to bail when he was trying to solo El Cap, and he decided to place one more pittern before he came down, and then he decided to place one more, and then like 11 days later he was at the top. My own favourite is perhaps a variation of the Invictus theme of being the captain of my own fate. In it, I visualise an old gnarled hand on the tiller of a small fishing boat tossed around in the ocean. There is every reason why the hand should turn and return to port, but the fisherman is not scared. He understands the sea and stays on course. So I don't know if that's appropriate, but so I'm sure I could waffle on about this a lot. Although you can't read from books, it's definitely worth reading as much as you can about people who overcome difficult things. Like, I would say like Goggins' book is a good one for that. A lot of those kind of books, like, I quite like kind of army kind of books, because they're always, you know, people have to go through, like, being in a war is probably the ultimate kind of shit to get through. Primo Levi's book, I think, is this a man, that's a good book about being in concentration, you know, a Jewish concentration camp, Alone at Sea by Hans Lindemann, about crossing the Atlantic in 11-foot long kayak in 1956 from the Canaries to the Caribbean is like amazing for me. It's an amazing book. But any books, again, like avoid fiction, you know, like the real non-fiction is, I think it's always more interesting, like how people, overcumption, that's another way of describing it. That's what Douglas Adams called this thing in Some People, how they can overcome problems. Overcumption is probably a better way of saying it. It's interesting. Maybe it's about the fight. Maybe it's about not. It's like there's something in some people where they won't give in. They just, you know, they just keep fighting. Like my book, The Down Book, has been like shortlisted for the Banff Mountain Book Festival Award. Like there's one category for guidebooks and instructional books, and so Down is in there, and Pete Whitaker's book's in there, like his crack climbing book, and Ian Parnell's Hard Rock book. Which is weird, really, because I know the other two, they all used to live in Sheffield. So that's quite a good that three kind of British authors have got books in there. Although I illustrated my book as well. And so the book, you know, you have this thing from Banff saying about your books in the shortlist. You know, it's either me, Ian, or Pete are going to win this book award. And and the Banff people, you know, they're all like lovely people, but they're all very, like most climbers are all very like, they're all very like left leaning, you know, tree hugging, you know, stroke a polar bear kind of people. So I always feel like I'm always a bit of a pain in the arse because I'm not, I don't really play that character kind of very well. And I remember, like, I found out the news that I was up for this shortlist. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. Like, I felt really honoured I won that award for like 1001 climbing tips. So it was like really cool to get like another one. I forgot one to get some money, maybe, don't know. But it was really cool to get to get it. And I think Higher Education got nominated before. And I always remember when Higher Education didn't win. I was like, I wonder if it didn't win because I was a bit controversial, or I'd like tweeted something or said something, and people would be like, oh, I can't give him, you know, like. And I just saw like Donald Trump didn't win a Nobel. I think he had 3 Nobel Peace Prize nominations. And whether you like Donald Trump or not, I think the what's going on in the Middle East like deserves probably some kind of Nobel Peace Prize, and that's quite a big. I think it's quite a big deal. Anyway, so he didn't win it, but like if it hadn't been Donald Trump, then would he have won? Maybe, probably. But these things always go in your head, like, and Vanessa's the saying, like, Vanessa doesn't like anything controversial. She's like, no, don't say anything or do anything controversial because you'll piss anybody off. Otherwise, you know, you're gonna have to get this, you might jeopardize your chances of getting this award. And I was sitting on the beach, and unfortunately I managed to get hold of her phone. I was like flicking through the phone. I was looking for a hat for going running in, some running kind of hat, and to keep the rain off my face, because it's always raining here. And I went on the Patagonia website, and unfortunately I saw the thing where it said that Patagonia is an anti-racist, working to become an anti-racist company. And in that moment, I just had this like this urge to make a joke about it, you know, they always cared more about salmon than about people of colour or something. And part of me was like, don't do it. Don't take the piss out of them. People just think you're a racist if you make fun of anti-racist people who say they're anti-racists. But I couldn't help myself. And I just took the piss out of them. I said something that you could tell they were racist because they used like YKK zips. But people didn't realize I was joking, so they were like, everyone, loads of trousers have YKK zips, good luck with that. So but I would say that is kind of an expression of resilience, if that makes any sense, is to not be a pain in the arse and to not comment on something like that, which is in my character, to take the piss out of those kind of things, would be to sacrifice something that somebody else is in control, or something else is in control of me, and I would then not feel in control of myself, if that makes any sense. So, or maybe that's just an excuse for this. So anyway, we're on that negative note. I'll tell you if I win or lose, but we shall see. But anyway, the other two guys are equally deserving of Pete's. I don't know if you've read Pete's book, Pete's crack climbing book. Really good. It's funny because I gave Pete a copy of my soloing book, and then he really got into like rope soloing. And I think maybe potentially his book is a little bit like one of my books, and it's like super, super, super detailed. Like it's like an obsessive compulsive person's book about crack climbing. It's very, very detailed, but very, really, really good. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk to some people coming up. So maybe I'll do some podcasts where I'm not talking myself for like fucking hours. And thanks for all the emails and messages saying I'm glad I've come back to podcasting. Maybe you don't agree on that now. And that's it. Until next time.
Goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.